ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Good evening and welcome to PM. I'm Samantha Donovan, coming to you from the lands of the Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nation in Melbourne. Tonight, the Treasurer Jim Chalmers confirms the government is axing the power bill subsidy. Also in Western Australia, a coroner rules that 16-year-old Cleveland Dodd died in inhumane conditions in youth detention. And voters in New England react to the latest move of their local MP, Barnaby Joyce.
But when he joined One Nation just today, it's gone to full anger for a moment. I'm hoping it will just be a hot flash and then they'll go back to board.
First this evening, the Federal Treasurer Jim Chalmers has confirmed today that the government's $300 power bill subsidy program will end this month as planned. The allowance of $75 a quarter began in mid-2023 and was applied to household energy bills directly. Some small businesses were also eligible. Economists have credited it with helping to curtail electricity price rises and driving down inflation and interest rates. Dr. Chalmers insists he has plans to roll out other cost of living relief measures in the months ahead. Nick Grimm reports.
The Federal Treasurer is keen to play down any expectations of government largesse in next week's mid-year budget update.
It will be sensible, not a spend-a-thon. It will be sensible, it will be responsible, and it will be restrained.
And that, Jim Chalmers says, means taking some hard choices.
And the Cabinet has decided today on one difficult decision in particular. The Cabinet decided this morning not to extend the electricity bill rebates. There have been three rounds of electricity bill rebates and there won't be a fourth.
After more than 2 years using those rebates to keep a lid on energy prices, the government discount of $75 per quarter for all households will end this month. The Federal Opposition has welcomed the end of the rebate. Here's Senator Andrew Bragg.
We need to do a better job going forward to protect people, but it's not going to be resolved with these sort of rebates because it's just masking the overall problem, which is that we don't have enough energy supply.
The decision to cut the rebate had been widely anticipated.
When they announced this in the budget earlier this year, they did just call it a 6 month extension and we are at that 6 month point now. So I think that's really what the timing's about.
Alison Reeve is the Energy and Climate Change Director at the Grattan Institute.
Unless you were going to make this a permanent feature, which would not have really been a good thing. I mean, my understanding is it was costing the budget around $7 billion a year. It was going to have to come off at some point.
Well, I think the government has decided that the cost of continuing with the energy bill rebates is just too high. It's costing billions and billions of dollars a year.
Shane Oliver is chief economist at AMP. He believes the federal government is doing the right thing, bringing the rebates to an end, though he admits it will inevitably lead to higher inflation.
Well, if we continued with these subsidies, not only does it cost the budget, but you get to the point where, well, maybe they will never end. We'll forever be subsidising lower energy bills, and that's not an appropriate way to go. That said, it will add to inflation, and unfortunately, people will see that through their energy bills. Basically, it adds about 20, 25, 27% perhaps to energy prices as we go through next year, which in turn, of course, will add to inflation.
And it is often said that while these rebates might provide a bit of short-term relief for households, trying to wean the economy off them is no easy task.
That's right. It is very hard to wean the economy off subsidies once they're started. You can see the impact from the state-based subsidies that occurred a year ago. Various states, notably Queensland, had quite sizable subsidies in place. They ended about a year ago. That resulted in something like a 37% rise in average electricity prices across Australia. And of course, was one factor behind that 3.8% rise in consumer prices over the year to October. But the problem with subsidies is that once you start them, you know, it's very hard to end them. And you see this right around the world. Some countries even have protests in the streets once subsidies are ended, particularly for fuel. So I think it's best to end this as scheduled and look for other better ways to bring down electricity prices. Quite how that will work, I don't know. But I think that's probably a more sustainable path to go rather than continue to have the taxpayers effectively pay themselves back as households via these subsidies.
It is said that ending this rebate will provide the government with a saving of about $2 billion. Now, is that money that should be made available for cost of living relief, or should the government, in your view, bank that saving?
Look, I think they should bank that saving. Cost of living relief has been used over the last couple of years, and it hasn't had a sustained impact in lowering inflation or easing the burden. And now we've seen inflation bounce back up again. I think the better approach would be for the government to seek ways to reduce government spending. Government spending has grown dramatically over the last 5 years. Yes, it's been a factor in keeping the economy going through the slowdown in the private sector on the back of high interest rates, but it's also meant higher inflation than would otherwise have been the case and higher interest rates than would otherwise have been the case because the government is effectively, in all its spending, competing with the private sector for resources.
AMP's chief economist Shane Oliver, that report from Nick Grimm. The former leader of the Nationals, Barnaby Joyce, has today confirmed he is joining Pauline Hanson's One Nation Party. A former Deputy Prime Minister, Mr. Joyce resigned from the Nats late last month. After well-publicised meetings with Ms. Hanson, his move to One Nation has been widely anticipated. He released a lengthy statement today to justify his decision and emphasised the cost of living, social cohesion, the role of family, the need for a strong defence force, his opposition to the government's climate change policies, and concerns about immigration levels. Mr. Joyce has been the member for the New South Wales seat of New England since 2013. In the state's north, the electorate is a prominent farming area and includes towns like Tamworth and Armidale. Dr. Raffaella Crosby is the publisher of the New England Times, an independent local news website. She studied voter behaviour and why people vote for Barnaby Joyce for her doctorate. And I asked her how New England voters are responding to the news their local member is now representing One Nation.
It's been really interesting, actually. When he first announced that he was leaving the National Party and going independent, they were a little bit bored. They were a bit over the performance of what is dealing with Barnaby Joyce as your local member. And they were quite happy for him to serve out the rest of his term and on the crossbenches, and that was fine. But when he joined One Nation just today, it's gone to full anger for a moment. I'm hoping it will just be a hot flash and then they'll go back to board.
Why are they so angry, do you think?
I think it's the betrayal. And I was talking to a few people and they were bringing up the fact that he'd hidden his health during the election. And there were a lot of National Party loyalists who were a little bit angry about that, that they weren't trusted with the truth that he was unwell and needed to undergo treatment for prostate cancer during the election. And that combined with this, you know, defection to what a lot of people up here do not see as a comparable party, they don't support the views of One Nation, is really seen as a betrayal of those who trusted him and worked really hard for him for a really long time.
What else are they saying about their local member representing One Nation?
They're very angry about the idea that we will be branded as being supportive of One Nation values. So one of the big kind of cognitive dissonance issues that we've had here in the New England for a long time is that the vast majority of New Englanders do not support the views of Barnaby Joyce. They thought he was a good local member. You know, when you need him, he was there to do your opening or write a letter for you. And he was an effective local member at that level. But they really didn't like that city people thought that we were backwards, that we didn't support renewable energy, or that we didn't support climate change action because Barnaby didn't. That simply wasn't the case. Barnaby wasn't seriously contested for, you know, three election cycles now. So it's really difficult for a lot of people now to be thinking that people in the city are going to think that we're racist. We're not. New Englanders take a very high premium on being respectful of others. Armidale is the case study of welcoming refugees. We don't want to be associated with the views of One Nation.
One Nation, though, appears to be gaining support, particularly in regional areas. It's on a bit of a high at the moment. You don't think that One Nation is going to appeal to quite a large chunk of voters in New England?
Not in my poll, no. So we've been polling, well, I've personally been polling both through my PhD before the New England Times existed, and now it's called the New England Times Engage poll. We do a poll once every 6 weeks or so, and we track voter intention in that. And other than the usual kind of bump that you see to non-major parties immediately after the election, the support that we're seeing for One Nation now is actually below what Brent Larkham got in the 2025 election.
And Dr. Crosby, you actually studied voter patterns in New England and yes. In particular support for Barnaby Joyce. How do you reflect on where his political career stands at the moment?
This is the lowest ebb by far. I mean, most people don't really understand why people vote for Barnaby Joyce, but in New England, it's very much about loyalty. And we dance with the one that brung you to a certain extent. The love for the National Party is deep. It's multi-generational and it tolerates a lot of things. I always kind of quip that you don't lose votes in New England for getting drunk or getting laid, but you do lose votes for lying to people or betraying their trust.
Is there any chance that before the election in 2028 that Barnaby Joyce will be forced to resign his seat?
I don't think anybody can force him to resign, but I expect that the social pressure to resign will become quite intense. Whether or not it's intense for a short period and then it dies off and people just kind of hang around and wait for the next election, we'll wait to see. Certainly the operatives of other parties that I've spoken to, and indeed the National Party, they're not keen for an early election. They're very happy to stay focused on the state election first, and then they'll get into what happens next with New England. So they're not really gearing up for a by-election. But if they go to a by-election, it'll be a very big field. There's certainly a number of independents have already kind of shown their colours.
Dr. Raffaella Crosby is the publisher of the New England Times, an independent local news website in Barnaby Joyce's electorate. This is PM. I'm Samantha Donovan. Just a reminder, you can hear all our programs live or later on the ABC Listen app. A West Australian coroner is calling for the urgent closure of a notorious youth detention facility after conducting an inquest into the death of 16-year-old Cleveland Dodd. His 2023 death was the first to be recorded in the state's youth detention system. The coroner likened the facility south of Perth to a 19th century jail and said the care of the teenager was inhumane. He's made 19 recommendations, and a warning: this story by Isabel Masali mentions incidents of self-harm.
Outside a Perth court, a small grieving crowd carries hand-painted signs calling for the closure of Unit 18. Moments later, Coroner Philip Urquhart recommended just that as he handed down his findings into the death of an Indigenous teen.
No child in detention deserves to be treated in the way Cleveland and the other young people in Unit 18 were treated at the time he decided to end his life.
In 2023, 16-year-old Cleveland Dodd was being held in a youth wing that was hastily set up within a maximum security adult prison. The small group of young detainees were deemed too difficult to manage at WA's dedicated youth detention facility.
Prolonged periods in solitary confinement, isolation, intense boredom, eating all their meals by themselves, and lack of access to mental health services, education, and even running water.
The inquest heard Cleveland had asked for a psychologist and warned many times that he would self-harm. The coroner found CCTV cameras to monitor detainees were covered or obscured, staffing was inadequate, and Cleveland's cell was not safe for a detainee at risk of self-harm.
What the inquest heard from those who worked in Unit 18 in and before October 2023 was alarming, unexpected, and confronting. They described conditions as chaotic, dangerous, and like a war zone.
Coroner Philip Urquhart said the inquest was the saddest he's presided over and handed down 19 recommendations. He says many have been supported by the Department of Justice, but some haven't. He's called on the government to consider sharing the responsibility for youth justice with another department, as happens in other states, and he's recommended an inquiry into how Unit 18 came to be.
Finally, I've made three recommendations regarding the future of Unit 18. The most significant of these is that Unit 18 be closed as a matter of urgency. Although I accept that additional resources and improvements have occurred in the management of Unit 18 since Cleveland's death, I am of the view that it is still not fit for purpose.
Cleveland's mother, Nadine, didn't speak to media today, but she released a statement saying her pain is as intense now as when she heard of his death. While she hopes the coroner's findings and recommendations will lead to change, she says it depends upon a massive fundamental shift in the Department of Justice's approach, which is yet to be seen.
Unit 18 must be shut down immediately.
That's Cleveland Dodd's auntie, Eunice Mippy. She's not satisfied with the findings.
We just want justice. We want someone to be held accountable for our nephew's death and what's been done and what's been happening in that place.
The family's been supported by suicide prevention advocate Megan Cracker.
We need strong leaders, strong humanitarians that will stand up and fight back against the system and say, no, this is wrong, because what they did is absolutely wrong.
But the state government won't be closing Unit 18 anytime soon. Premier Roger Cook repeating his message that an alternative facility must be built first, and that's not expected to open for 3 years. He says he's confident significant changes have been made to youth detention since Cleveland's death.
We will close it as soon as it's safe and that there's an alternative facility for those detainees to go to. But these projects are notoriously hard to get moving, but we want to make sure that gets built as quickly as possible.
The West Australian Premier Roger Cook, Isabel Massali reporting. And if you've found that story distressing, you can call Lifeline on 13 11 14 or the Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander Crisis Support Line. That's 13 YARN 13 92 76. Staying with the issue of child welfare, and a review of Queensland's child protection system has found the offending of one of the nation's worst paedophiles should have been discovered and stopped much earlier than it was. Last year, Ashley Paul Griffith pleaded guilty to 300 child abuse charges committed in childcare centres in Brisbane and Italy. He's now serving life in prison with a non-parole period of 27 years. The review has made 28 recommendations, and the Queensland Premier, David Crisafulli, says a new scheme for the reporting of child abuse allegations will start earlier than planned. Elizabeth Cramsey filed this report.
The report is caught in plain sight because too often those that seek to abuse children are standing right in front of us.
The offending of notorious paedophile Ashley Paul Griffith is some of the worst in Australia's history. And Queensland's Children's Commissioner, Luke Twyford, has mapped out just how his offending was allowed to continue.
They do not hide in shadows. They do not hide in attics. They are in our workplaces. They are in our neighbourhoods. And they are in our organisations. This report lays bare that this is not a one-off case where our systems failed. It is an example where our systems were inadequate.
Luke Twyford and the rest of the Child Death Review Board were tasked with examining Queensland's child protection system, using Ashley Paul Griffith as a case study. They found there were multiple opportunities where the childcare worker should have been detected and stopped.
I was shocked to find 18 missed opportunities where an alternative pathway would have led to his earlier detection. This is not someone that escaped all eyes or visibility. Children spoke up about him. Parents spoke up about him. Colleagues and centre managers spoke up about him. He was dismissed from his employment on more than 5 occasions. He had police investigations into his conduct. He had early childcare regulatory investigations into his conduct. And yet none of that made a difference.
The report found the state's Working with Children check, called a blue card, functioned as intended, but did little to protect children or alert organisations to risk. 28 recommendations have been made, and they've been broken up into operational and transformational. One of those calls for the state's reportable conduct scheme, which is due to be operational next year, to be run by the same entity as the worker screening scheme. Queensland Premier David Crisafulli says action is being taken.
I can confirm that the Queensland Government will be fast-tracking a reportable conduct scheme in this state. It is essential that we do that. It is essential that we give every chance for our institutions to keep our children safe. We will be pulling that forward 12 months in a bid to make sure that we can have a reportable conduct scheme that does what is the job of any good government, and that is to keep our kids safe.
Reportable conduct schemes were a recommendation from the National Royal Commission into Institutional Responses to Child Sexual Abuse in 2017. Queensland's Attorney General wants to know why Queensland is falling behind other states and territories.
The Royal Commission recommended that governments across Australia should bring in a reportable conduct scheme. Now, while other states did this, the Queensland Labor government sat on their hands.
Luke Twyford and the Child Death Review Board will now wait to see which recommendations the state government chooses to prioritise.
This man was ultimately caught because he uploaded photos to the darknet when he was living in Italy. There is something wrong with our system when so many victims and colleagues and witnesses speak up, and yet there is no effective outcome.
Luke Twyford is the Children's Commissioner in Queensland. Elizabeth Cramsey with that report. Well, we're only a week into summer and Australians are already mourning the death of a firefighter in New South Wales and lamenting the loss of dozens of homes in fires in that state and Tasmania over the weekend. As Rachel Hayter reports, emergency authorities are warning against complacency as the fire season continues.
Grieving the death of their colleague in the very first week of summer. Today, firefighters battled 49 fires across New South Wales, 9 of which were not contained.
There is something deeply Australian about people who will put themselves forward to protect our community in their time of need.
The Commissioner of the New South Wales Rural Fire Service, Trent Curtin, is honouring the sacrifice of a 59-year-old firefighter who's yet to be named. He was with the state's National Parks and Wildlife Service and died after being hit by a falling tree on a fire ground in Narong, north of Newcastle, last night.
This firefighter's loss will be felt so deeply across all of our organisations here in New South Wales and right across the country.
Authorities are referring to that blaze as the Bulladilla Fire, and it's destroyed 4 homes. Further south, at least another 16 homes have been destroyed in the Coolawong fire on the central coast, including Mark Quinlan's home of more than 2 decades.
It's all just a numb feeling. 26 years built it and then just watch it slowly catch on fire and then collapse.
Another local and retired firefighter, Mark Stringfellow, has raised concerns about the lack of water pressure in Coolawong.
I had no water in the hose and I've got sprinklers on the roof and I turned them on, but there wasn't enough pressure.
Despite that problem, Mark Stringfellow stayed and tried to wet things down before being helped out of the fire zone by police.
They put me in a car, police car. We drove through flames and smoke. One section, you couldn't see a thing.
He then joined other locals in the waterfront park in Coolawong, witnessing their homes burn.
That was really sad because we were watching houses that I didn't think were at risk, the ones along the railway line, fully engulfed in flame.
Dean Naramore from the Bureau of Meteorology warns the fire danger in New South Wales is expected to spike again tomorrow.
Another challenging day on Tuesday for parts of New South Wales. The good news is we should see the pattern shift a little bit on Wednesday. We'll see a cooler change move up the coast again Tuesday night. And that'll be a challenge as well for our fires as the winds go from northerly to a southerly direction.
Widespread rain and thunderstorms are forecast for large parts of New South Wales on Thursday and Friday. Meanwhile, Tasmania is dealing with its own bushfires. In that state, 19 homes have been destroyed and more damaged after fire tore through the east coast community of Dolphin Sands. It was one of 30 blazes that broke out across Tasmania last Thursday amid strong winds, despite no official warning for dangerous fire conditions being issued.
It just was just so windy. It was just impossible for them to control it.
As the fire bore down, oyster farmer Cassie Melrose gathered her family and some neighbours and twice evacuated onto the water.
It was terrifying. We were just watching it thinking that it's all gone. You could see flames in front of our house, behind our house, around our house.
Ultimately, the family's home survived, but some accommodation for farm workers was lost.
We are so, so lucky.
Beyond this week, the Bureau of Meteorology warns high temperatures are expected to return to parts of eastern Australia in the week leading into Christmas. The New South Wales Rural Fire Service is worried after years of wet summers and a drier than forecast spring. There's complacency in the community ahead of a dangerous summer.
That report from Rachel Hayter and Alexandra Humphreys. Thanks for joining me for PM. I'm Samantha Donovan. We'll be back at the same time tomorrow. Good night.
Hi, I'm Sydney Peed from ABC News Daily podcast. Parents and teens are getting ready for life cut off from social media when Australia's world-first ban for under-16s officially starts on Thursday. The government says it will take time to remove all under-16s from the platforms, and it's becoming clear older users could get caught in the net. Today, tech reporter Jennifer Dudley Nicholson on what to know ahead of the ban. Look for the ABC News Daily podcast on the ABC Listen app.